This program does not create an attorney-client relationship between Moss and Barnett, a professional association, or any attorney appearing on this program and any caller or listener. Please remember that we can only give general information, and every case is unique. Always check with your individual attorney for any specific legal concerns. If you are in need of specific legal advice or are looking for an attorney, please do not hesitate to give Moss and Barnett a call at 612-877-5000.
This is WCCO's Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett.
Thanks so much for joining us. It is Minnesota Law on a Sunday because we had a wild game on Saturday, and we're pleased, as always, to have our host, Tom Schroyer, and we have a regular contributor to the program joining us today, Tom.
That's right. We brought back for our listeners our lawyer's lawyer, and since the first of the year, the chief operating officer of Moss and Barnett, none other than Kevin Bush. Good afternoon, Kevin.
Thanks, Tom. It's good to be back.
You have been a regular, as Steve just mentioned, and you've covered a variety of topics, but most prominently over the last year or so, we've had a series on what is known as the Uniform Commercial Code. And we've talked about the history of that Uniform Code. We've talked about other areas of the code. Today, we're going to talk about a particular portion of the Uniform Commercial Code, or sometimes abbreviated UCC, and that is Article 2. Kevin, maybe you can give us a brief recap of where we've been.
When we looked at the Article 2 in our last show, we found that it covers a broad range of transactions involving sales for both consumers and businesses, ranging from a simple transaction such as the sale of a used kitchen utensil at a garage sale for a quarter up to equipment to fill a full factory for hundreds of millions of dollars. We looked at how those contracts are formed, and we looked at how we determine what provisions are in those contracts. Today, I'd like to switch to the backside of these contracts and what happens when something goes wrong.
Yes, and as I recall, the purpose of the Uniform Commercial Code is to provide an overarching structure throughout the entire United States and to unify the law of all the states so that businesses and consumers and people who work in the commercial area can know in advance with some reasonable degree of predictability what their rights and responsibilities are.
Correct, and particularly to help us solve transactions that go bad. There are millions of UCC sales transactions completed every day. Most of them go off without any problem at all.
In fact, literally, I think pretty much everybody enters into a UCC Article 2 business transaction in their daily lives.
Almost every day. Every time we buy gas at the gas station or a sandwich at the deli or anything else that we purchase at any store or online. All of those are UCC transactions, and most of them are completed without any trouble. But because there are millions of these transactions every day, some don't work well, and that's where we need to change to the backside of Article 2 to deal with problem resolution.
And as I understand the word of today, it's going to be warranty. And that's the legal word for the protection or the remedy that people get when a deal goes south on them.
The warranties provided by Article 2 are used to solve problems, and they come in quite a variety of flavors under two main headings. We have implied warranties and express warranties. Express warranties are the ones that we usually think of, the 50,000-mile, 5-year warranty on a car, or a lifetime warranty on replacement windows. Those are the ones we see in writing. Implied warranties are not in writing, but they are just as enforceable as written express warranties and are provided by the UCC even if there's nothing in writing at all provide very strong protections to the purchaser.
It gets a little confusing. I hear the word guarantee sometimes. I hear the word warranty. I hear in some of my, or I read in some of my contracts that I see in my daily professional life that people warrant something. How do these all work together?
The words are used somewhat loosely. The, Article 2 uses the term warranty, which is a specialized form of promise. It's a promise by the seller that certain attributes of the goods that are being sold are as the seller says they are.
Very, very well. And you've just said that there are two kinds of warranties, the written kind, which are express, and then there are implied warranties. Do these warranty rights arise under Article 2 in every transaction?
All sales transactions have warranties. We'll talk a little later about disclaimers, which can show up to negate certain types of warranties in a particular situation. But Article 2 does provide warranties in all situations.
It really sort of, is hard to get our minds around the idea that every transaction has a warranty that's implied in it, when you've just said that every time we go to the gas station or the grocery store and make a purchase, we're governed by Article 2. Do those kinds of transactions also come with warranties?
They do. We'll talk in a moment about a warranty called the Warranty of Merchantability. And that is a very important warranty that is provided in all sorts of transactions, including all of those consumer transactions that you mentioned.
I'm guessing that merchantability tails back to the stores and gas stations being merchants.
Exactly right.
All right. Now, there's another warranty law running around out here that I remember from my days way back in law school, and that is the Magnuson-Moss Act. How does that intersect here with Article 2 and warranties?
The Magnuson-Moss Warranty Act is a federal law, which is different from the UCC, which is a law in each of the states. But the federal Magnuson-Moss Warranty Act is designed to ensure that warranties that are given under state law are provided with clear language and are enforced in a way that is fair to consumers. It applies only to consumer transactions. And it does not require that there be warranties, only that if warranties are given, they be given in a particular way.
I don't know, Steve, how you feel about it, but when I get a new widget or stereo or TV or whatever and it has this warranty and I've got to go register it, it kind of annoys me that I have to go to the online deal and do that. But so let me ask, Kevin, is it necessary to go register a warranty to get a warranty protection under the Magnuson-Moss Act?
The warranties do not need to be registered. They're provided by statute. There are practical benefits that can be obtained from the manufacturers or the sellers by registering it, but the warranties themselves are there regardless of the registration.
It would seem to me, with particular devices, if there was a recall or some sort of update, that they would have your contact information to be able to tell you about a problem or update or whatever.
Certainly one of the benefits of registering a warranty.
And I will add a quick, homely story. My father had a coffee maker. He registered the warranty. I never would have done that. And when he needed a new pot for it, he called up the company, and they checked, and they said, you registered your warranty, so we'll give you a new pot for free. So you never know what good might come of that.
Yeah, I'm always worried about the capture of private information. I think that's a lot of people's concern. What are they going to do with this info once they receive it?
It's certainly a concern, particularly with Internet access and emails that come in that aren't desirable.
Sounds like a topic for another show, actually.
Absolutely, and it would be a good idea. You give up your private information, but if you get a free coffee pot out of the deal, it seems worthwhile. We're going to take a break. We have a whole lot more coming up on the program. It is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett. Kevin Bush in studio today. Tom Schroyer is our host. More on Article 2, the heart of the UCC. By the way, for more information on this program and all our other programs, go online, moss-barnett.com. Minnesota Law returns in a moment here on News Radio 830 WCC.
This is Sidebar on Minnesota Law.
You can't handle the truth.
Excuse me, Your Honor. Two youths.
Are you sure this is legal?
You think you know every trick in the book, and they come up with another one.
Did you know Moss and Barnett attorney Clifford A. Taney Jr. went on to fame while serving during World War II as general counsel to the super-secret nuclear development program of the U.S. Army, known as the Manhattan Project?
Minnesota Law is presented by Moss and Barnett and returns in a moment on News Radio 830 WCCO. Minnesota's radio station is News Radio 830 WCCO.
Thank you.
We return. It is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett. Today on a Sunday, typically their show's on Saturdays at noon. We had a Wild game on Saturday. Tom Schroyer is in studio. Our host, Kevin Bush, is joining us. More on Article 2, the heart of the UCC.
Thanks, Steve. In some measure, we are doing some heavy legal plumbing work here today with Kevin Bush, who is expert on the Uniform Commercial Code. In particular, we're talking about Article 2 and its warranty remedies, the warranties that come with literally every commercial transaction in Minnesota and every other state. And Kevin, we wanted to talk about a little bit more about those warranties. They are both express or in writing and implied, which means they just come with the deal as a matter of law.
Let's start with the implied warranties. The first of them is a warranty of title. It seems rather obvious to say this, but the seller does in fact provide a warranty that the seller owns what the seller is selling, and that there aren't any liens on the property being sold. And the consumer normally does not need to worry about that. Anything that we buy at a store is going to come free of any other claims. But if I'm buying something off the back of a pickup truck late at night in a deserted parking lot, I might not be buying something where there's good title. And I need to be concerned about that, because even though that seller gives me a warranty of title by statute, it may be hard to enforce.
Well, and in my practice, which does delve into intellectual property litigation, I know that software integrators who buy prepackaged, pre-programmed software and then integrate it in creative ways with their customers are also making that warranty. Oftentimes, it's express in their software or in their contract with their customers, and they, too, even though they're only passing through the software, are conveying a warranty of non-infringement of patent or copyright, and they can get into some big trouble because it's very hard, almost impossible, to know all of the possible ways in which a software patent might or software program might encroach somebody else's intellectual property.
It's a difficult area, and Article 2 provides a warranty of what we call non-infringement, that there's no impairment of somebody else's intellectual property rights. When I buy a computer at one of the big box stores, it comes preloaded with a lot of software. I'm entitled to know that that's legitimate software that hasn't been pirated, and if I run into trouble because it is not legitimate software, I'm entitled to make a claim for an infringement warranty against that big box store that sold it to me.
Let's turn to retailers, grocery stores, and the like, convenience stores. And we talked in the first segment about this odd little word called phrase called the warranty of merchantability. What's that all about?
This is a warranty that is very important for every sales transaction involving merchants, people who are in the business of selling goods of that kind. The transaction I mentioned at the neighborhood garage sale is not a merchant transaction because the people who sell at a garage sale aren't in the business of selling those goods. But a grocery store that sells groceries, a hardware store selling hardware, the manufacturer of any product selling what the manufacturer sells is a merchant in those goods and provides this warranty of merchantability. It's a funny word. I expect that except for those of us who write UCC contracts, none of us has ever used the word merchantability in a sentence.
I think that's a fair bet.
And actually, a funny story on this, sometimes our clients will take the contracts we write and run them through a spell check before they put it into their printed brochures, and merchantability gets kicked out and sometimes get rendered in ways that we did not intend.
I can only imagine.
While it's a very important word in the statute, it has a definition that is somewhat vague, and it's intentionally vague because we want the statute to be flexible to cover all kinds of goods and all kinds of situations. If we have to take the translation as best we can from the statute, it means that the goods are pretty good.
Pretty good.
Pretty good is the standard. It doesn't mean they're perfect. Doesn't mean they'll last forever, but it means that they're pretty good. And we're entitled to know that what we're buying will generally work it won't be hazardous to our health, and it'll last at least for a reasonable period of time.
A lot of weasel words, it seems to me, put in there by lawyers. I don't know.
But still a very important remedy because that's what we expect to get when we buy something. We expect to get something that's pretty good.
Now, what if I have a particular need when I go to the grocery store? I need to buy some butter, let's say not to spread on bread or toast, but rather for a particular purpose, maybe to make a butter a sculpture. And, you know, it doesn't hold together. I know, Steve, I never would do that. But but I guess the hypothetical is I need the butter for something weird, let's say that, and maybe it doesn't work.
It's possible that there would be a special warranty in that situation, a warranty for fitness for a particular purpose. And what that means is if I go to a store and say, I'm trying to solve a particular problem, what do you have that will work for this? And the store sells me something, they said, I have just the thing for you, and sells it to me, and it turns out it doesn't work for that, then it may be that even though what the retailer sold me was perfectly good, perfectly merchantable, but it didn't work for what I wanted, then I can take it back for the refund.
And is that along the lines of just using it for your intended purposes? I heard the story that someone went out, bought a lawnmower, and they used the lawnmower actually to attempt to trim their hedges and became severely injured. I mean, at the end of the day, that's not what it was intended for. It wasn't intended to trim hedges.
No, and there certainly would not be a warranty of merchantability for that. It was not intended to be pretty good for a hedge trimmer. And my guess is the seller in that situation didn't say, go ahead and use it for a hedge trimmer.
I suppose manufacturers can run afoul, though, if they have retail locations that are recommending their product for uses that it's not intended. I suppose that gets into a sticky area.
They can, and we'll talk about that a little bit later, about who can rely on what types of warranties. But in that case, the warranty is provided by the retailer, not by the manufacturer.
We have much more coming up. Fascinating show today, Kevin Bush. More on Article 2, the heart of the UCC. Tom Scheuer is our host on the program. By the way, we're coming your way on a Sunday because we had a Wild game on Saturday. Typically, Minnesota Law is broadcast Saturdays at noon, here on News Radio 830 WCCO.
News for Minnesota is heard on News Radio 830 WCCO.
Minnesota Law is back on a Sunday, typically Saturdays at noon. We had a Wild game on Saturday. By the way, for more information on today's program and all our other programs, go online, moss-barnett.com. Tom Scheuer is our host, Kevin Bush in studio. More on Article 2, the heart of the UCC.
Thanks, Steve. And I might tag on to your comment that on our website there is a dialogue box where our listeners can ask a question about the law if they choose to do so, and we'll make sure that they get an answer to their inquiry. We can't provide specific legal advice about their situation, but we'll do the best we can. And if we can't help them, we are often able, in fact, to tell them where they might be able to go for help. So that's a feature of our website that also might be of interest to folks. Brought to you by Moss and Barnett, a business law firm. And in that vein, we are talking today with one of the very leading commercial attorneys in our part of the country here, Kevin Bush, and we're talking about Article 2 of the Uniform Commercial Code. Kevin, we were dealing with warranties. We talked about implied warranties, and now we're going to talk about express warranties.
Express warranties are those that are stated in writing, although sometimes verbally, by a seller. And they come in almost an unlimited variety because sellers can construct them in any way that the sellers want. There doesn't have to be any express warranties in a contract, and sometimes sellers don't provide any. But they might be limited in any number of ways, so it's important to read them carefully to understand what's being provided and what isn't.
How will people know if they are getting an express warranty in a typical consumer transaction?
Typically, it's going to be in a product insert, maybe a tag on the item being purchased. There may, in fact, be a written contract, a sales invoice that has provisions on the back. All of those are sources where we might find an express warranty.
I see them more and more showing up on online, too, when I buy a product, and not necessarily in something readily visible, at least in the package in writing.
No, and the online ones are sometimes troubling because they are very lengthy, and in order to get to the next screen, we have to check a box that says that we've read this warranty.
And agree with it.
And those haven't been litigated very much yet, but probably will at some point.
Well, I wish I could say I'd read each of those that I checked. Yes, I agree to, but I would be not truthful if I did. Like you say, you're ready to get onto the next screen, so have at it. All right, so express warranties, I suppose the sky's the limit in terms of what they can provide and how they can be shaped and limited by the authors of the warranties that are being expressly given.
And they're quite variable depending upon the type of product, the industry, what the competition is doing, what the consumer expects to see. Again, it's very important for the consumer to read what's there, to understand what's being provided so that there aren't a lot of surprises. There's a funny case that was reported a year or so ago involving some Tiffany lamps sold at an auction sale. And they were shown in the brochure for the auction as Tiffany lamps, and the person purchased them on that basis. They turned out to be knockoffs that were not worth $25,000 but were worth $25. And the auction house defended it, the claim, on grounds that the brochure was full of disclaimers. And the court said, no, you said in the brochure that this was a Tiffany lamp. And that meant that was a warranty, that it was, in fact, a Tiffany lamp. It didn't say Tiffany-like or Tiffany style. It said Tiffany lamp, and that was enough to create a completely enforceable express warranty.
I'm going to guess that in the disclaimers that auction house published, that it said something like, you take it as is, and we make no representations or warranties about the quality or background, et cetera, of the light.
The brochure said all of those things, but still, because the brochure said this Tiffany lamp, that was enough to create a warranty that could not be disclaimed.
And often, if people wander used car lots around town, vehicles are sold as is. And when Tom brought up as is, that kind of spurred a thought.
The UCC does allow the use of as is as a warranty disclaimer, but if that car is listed on the invoice as being a Chevrolet, and in fact it isn't, that probably is provided an express warranty, even with the as-is.
Every once in a while I get a call from a client who's wondering if there isn't some automatic right to return a used car that turns out to be an absolute clunker, and they figure it out within a day or two or three. And I think the answer is no.
Some dealers do provide that right, but most often not.
Right, and even on a new car warranty, the express warranties that we hear about, those are at the discretion of the car manufacturers.
They need to be read carefully to understand what sort of rights they provide.
Now, it's possible to get rid of some of these waivers by disclaimers?
A seller can provide disclaimers in the sales contract to limit the types of warranties, particularly the implied warranties of merchantability. Often those are they try to disclaim them. It's difficult to disclaim an express warranty, as we just mentioned in the Tiffany case. If there is a statement that a good satisfies a particular standard on the front of a document, we can't use fine print on the back to take that away.
All right. The sale of phony Tiffany glass by an auction house is a good jumping-off point for us to talk, I think, now about buyer's rights. If I have purchased the Tiffany lamp at the auction and it turns out not to be a Tiffany lamp, what are my rights?
A buyer's rights come in three categories based on the time. We'll call them the first phase is the perfect tender phase, perfect tender. The second is substantial impairment phase, and the final is the damages or warranty phase.
Well, obviously, we're going to have to break this down. Okay, what is the perfect tender phase, which, as you said, the first phase?
That stage lasts for a few minutes to a few days, typically, although the UCC doesn't give us a specific time frame. And what it means in that that phase is the goods have to comply exactly or perfectly with what the contract says they were going to be.
All right. So if I get home and I find out when I'm putting my groceries away that I got a rotten apple, I can go take it back and say to the store, you didn't make a perfect tender of this apple to me, therefore you've got to take it back?
Correct, because that didn't comply with the contract. You returned it as soon as you discovered it, within a few minutes to a day or so, and the seller needs to take it back because at that point you're entitled to get exactly what it was you were promised.
And there's no bright line test or automatic definition as to how fast I have to do that.
There isn't. And your case is kind of an easy one because it's a rotten apple. It's clearly non-compliant. But what if you had been promised an apple of a particular variety and one of them happened to be a different variety in that same mix?
Sure, or it came out with a brown spot I didn't see before I bought it.
And all of those are defects that allow you during this perfect tender phase to return it for a full refund.
Okay, so even the slightest blemish is grounds for a refund.
Even the slightest blemish. Now, most of us wouldn't do that in most cases because it's not worth it, and we got substantially what we were looking for. But the point is that from a statutory perspective, we need to give the seller control over the transaction and the buyer the control so that they get and give exactly what they were promised.
And the good news is most retailers, most reputable retailers, want to make sure their customers are happy.
Right.
So if someone comes back and say, you know, these bananas taste funny, you know, I ate most of them, but, you know, they're going to probably make good on that. They don't want to run afoul of their customers.
Right. The sellers are very often going to go beyond what's required in the UCC.
After this perfect tender phase, Kevin, what follows then? Do I have any rights, or am I just out of luck if I didn't get what I bargained for?
The next phase we call the substantial impairment phase. And what that does, it runs from the end of the perfect tender phase after a couple of days and runs for a couple of months. Exactly when it ends, we don't know for sure. But the case law tries to deal with that. And what this says is, now we're past that perfect tender phase. You missed the opportunity to return it. But if it really is bad, if it's a substantial impairment, not just a slight impairment, but a substantial impairment, you can return the goods for a full refund. Let's use a loaf of bread as an example. If I take that home, it may look perfect on the outside, and I may not find out until a day or two or a week later that it's defective on the inside. It's rotten or uncooked on the inside. Even though it's now been several days, even several weeks, I can take it back because that loaf of bread is completely unusable for me. It's a substantial impairment.
Are there any limits on when I can exercise this right other than the running or passage of time?
No, there is no statutory cutoff point at the end of this. It needs to be within a reasonable time, and most of the cases deal with this measuring that in terms of months.
All right. If that period of reasonable time, in measured, as you say, in months, has expired, now what? Do I have to just hang on to my lemon?
Then turn to the last phase, which is the damages phase or warranty phase, and that runs from starting in a few months to as long as 4 years is a typical time frame that the UCC provides. There are provisions to shorten that in some contracts. It could be shortened as much as to 1 year, but 4 years is the most common.
And 4 years is the absolute cutoff unless it's extended by agreement of the parties.
Correct. And very often that 4 years is an absolute cutoff, and cases will get tossed for that reason.
We have much more Minnesota law coming up in a moment. Kevin Bush is in. More on Article 2, the heart of the UCC. Tom Schroyer is our host. Don't forget, Minnesota law typically on Saturdays between noon and 1 o'clock. We're on a Sunday today because of a Wild game yesterday. And for more info on today's program and all our other programs, go online, moss-barnett.com. It is Minnesota Law on a Sunday at News Radio 830 WCCO.
This is Sidebar on Minnesota Law.
You can't handle the truth.
Excuse me, Your Honor. Two youths.
Are you sure this is legal?
You think you know every trick in the book, and they come up with another one.
Did you know a team of Moss and Barnett attorneys worked on the appeal of the case that served as the basis for the motion picture, North Country?
Minnesota Law is presented by Moss and Barnett and returns in a moment on News Radio 830 WCCO.
From the Buick Studios, this is News Radio 830 WCCO.
Welcome back one more time. It is Minnesota Law presented by Moss and Barnett. Today on a Sunday, we had a wild game on Saturday. Normally, you'll hear the program Saturdays at noon here on News Radio 830 WCCO. We're pleased to have Tom Scheuer and Kevin Bush in studio. More on Article 2, the heart of the UCC.
Kevin, we're going to try to wrap up the program today by turning our attention to the final part of the remedy section of Article 2, dealing with warranties and how to implement them. And we were talking about the express warranty period and what has to be done and how long it runs, anywhere from up to as long as 4 years, I should say. Is there anything that a consumer or a buyer of merchandise has to do in order to invoke this particular warranty protection, this long-running warranty protection?
One thing that's very important for buyers is to notify the seller as soon as a problem becomes clear. Even if that's long before the 4 years expires, if the buyer knows about a problem and fails to tell the seller that the remedy may be lost very early on and will not be retrieved by the court later. The idea here is we want to give the seller a chance to correct things while the problems are still small, or even to make changes in objects or merchandise that's sold to other parties. So we encourage the prompt reporting, and it's very important for a buyer to do that to avoid losing remedies.
I imagine, though, that cooperative interlude there when people are trying to work things out, that itself could be fraught with peril.
We certainly want the seller to know about the problems, though, because the problems often can be solved easier and less expensively if they're addressed earlier rather than later.
All right. Well, what if I take my car in and I get, I've got something rattling around in the dashboard, and I take it in and they say, well, we fixed it, and it turns out they haven't. I take it back and they haven't, and so on. And before I know it, the 4 years of the warranty, express warranty period has been exhausted.
We always have to keep an eye on the end of the warranty period as well, and we do find situations where we actually have to start a lawsuit to preserve those rights even while we continue to negotiate.
All right. Well, let's say everything's failed. I don't get my refund or my replacement goods. The merchant fails to fix the defective merchandise. I end up having to go after damages. What can I get?
What we try to do in Article 2 is put the parties in the position that they would have been if the performance had been the way it had originally been planned. So for the buyer, we say, what's the difference in value between what you really got versus what you should have got? And with that, we'll provide damages equal to that difference. And if you think of an example, if I wanted to buy Class A goods and what I got were Class B goods, I can use the Class B, but it takes me an extra $1,000 of processing time or processing components. I'm entitled to get $1,000 of damages there for the difference in value between what I got and what I was supposed to get.
Can I go out and buy a replacement knowing that I'm going to get the price differential if I win on my warranty breach claim?
That's a process we call cover. It's called covering damages, going out and buying products to cover the exposure and then sue the seller for the difference in cost. We've seen gas prices spike. If I have a fleet of trucks and I have a contract to buy 10,000 gallons of gas at $2.50 a gallon, and my seller refuses to to sell to me because the price has gone up to $3.50, I'm entitled to a dollar a gallon difference because I had to go out and buy it at the much higher price.
Well, let's turn it around. Let's say I'm the seller and I'm selling you petroleum or refined gasoline even, and at the end of the day when I come to deliver, I have a contract price that's much higher than a sudden drop in the market price. Can the buyer refuse to take delivery? And if they do, what are the damages?
It is exactly the same set of damages. The seller is entitled to get the difference between what the contract price was and what the seller is ultimately able to sell the goods in the market.
We have just a short while left. What are the chances of picking up some of my incidental expenses to cover this? And if I have a damage situation, also, if I have to bring a lawsuit, can I get my attorney's fees?
Very often can pick up incidental expenses, extra charges that I incur because the goods didn't comply. Most often we cannot pick up attorney's fees. The American rule is that each party pays its own fees.
There he is, Kevin Bush. More in Article 2, the heart of the UCC. Tom Schroer, we've got a great program next week, Saturday at noon.
We're back on Saturday, and this time we'll have Minnesota Supreme Court Chief Justice Lori Gilday in to talk about her tenure on the court as Chief Justice and as an Associate Justice before that, and her work on the budget crisis.
And I promised I'll be on my best behavior next Saturday at noon.
Thanks so much, Steve.
We'll see you then. There he is, Tom Schroer. Thanks again to Kevin Bush. That is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett. For more info on today's program and all our other programs, go online, moss-barnett.com. Enjoy your day. It is News Radio 830 WCCO.